Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen. And I'm looking at the monitor right now, and it actually looks like I remembered to hit the record button this time.
Oh, perfect.
So that's a really good start.
In a few minutes, you'll just have to remember to hit the Save As button as well.
Save As is good and underrated. Well, I'm not. Yeah, we'll be okay, I think. If we're not, we'll just do it again. So March Madness is over.
Yes,
there was no joy in Mudville.
No, because they did actually play the Final Four, right? I was hoping that I'd had a nightmare, and coming up this Saturday, we'd get another crack at it.
It's funny, because you talk about the Final Four. To me, the championship game is a complete dog always. And the reason for this, it starts at 9:30.
Yeah.
Like, at 9:30, I'm usually on the couch, doing a little bit of work, getting ready to go to bed. Like, I'm done or close.
And it's a Monday night.
Like, I don't know. I understand that we want our friends on the West Coast to have the opportunity to watch the game.
Yeah.
But at what cost?
Right.
Like, you think about it. One shining moment happens, what, close to midnight?
Yeah.
Ugh, boring.
Yeah, why can't we go with the 8:30 tip?
That seems fair to me.
That gives the West Coasters a 5:30 tip.
West Coast bias. I have no problem with that. I really don't.
I was a little bit surprised this year because I've been ingrained to know that 8:49 is when things happen in the Final Four. The game two on Saturday night,
yes.
Projected tip is at 8:49. And I was thinking that's what it would be for Monday as well. And then the second time I looked, all of a sudden the tip was at 9:20. I was a little bit confused.
Yeah, it's just ridiculously late for that. So Villanova picked up a win, their second championship in, what, 3 years? Is that right?
Yep.
Because the one with Chris Jenkins and Ryan Archidiakono seems like that was ages ago.
It does.
And they did it behind 31 points off another classically named player, Dante DiVincenzo.
Well done on the first take.
Yeah, that's easier than Ryan Archidiakono. But good for Villanova. The talk after the fact was that Jay Wright, will Jay Wright leave? That's if we were doing sports talk on a station where we were trying to get the phones to ring, that would be what we would say.
Right.
Here, it's not as big of a consideration, but
that's because we haven't given out the phone number yet for the call-in line.
No, we will work on that. However, that kind of brings up the bigger thing. If you are a renowned college coach, if you're leading a big-time program and you know year in and year out that you're going to get the recruits, like Jay Wright doesn't really have to do a whole lot to recruit at this point. His track record recruits for him. What is the real reason to leave? If you're leaving college to go to the NBA, typically, now the discussion was he should become the coach of the Sixers, which really isn't fair to their existing coach, who's done a pretty good job with things, Brett Brown. But usually if you leave and go to the NBA, you're inheriting a garbage fire.
But you're getting paid eight figures.
Is
annually.
Okay, I wouldn't know what to do with
$5 million?
Seven figures. So, like, more money, more problems. Like,
well, you're trading. You know, normally you would think more money, more problems, but I think the allure for a lot of the coaches in college who've had success and then get an opportunity in the NBA is that you trade off some headaches.
Yes.
You don't have to recruit. You don't have to deal with NCAA compliance. You just focus on games and X's and O's and egos. So you get that.
Egos, yes.
You get a little bit different situation with chemistry with those egos. But the big draw in years past has been a significant increase in pay. But now it's gotten a little bit closer where a lot of the top college coaches make what a lot of the top NBA coaches make.
Right. It's not insignificant, but it becomes monopoly money at that point. And the other point, and I'll never forget when Pete Carroll was the coach of USC and winning championships every year, they always asked him, winning championships that would later be erased, but that's okay. They asked him, will you leave? And his answer was always, I don't want to leave. I can just restock every year. If you're an NBA coach, at least the way it stands now, your success in the future really depends on how ping pong balls bounce.
They do. Although, if they bounce correctly and you're in San Antonio and you get Tim Duncan instead of the Celtics,
right,
then you're set for 20 years.
Yeah,
you so you don't have to worry about restocking. You are stocked.
You could be set for 20 years, but you're also pretty well set because you have the coach that we were talking about last week, Popovich, who's done a very good job of, I'm not going to say, he's not as cranky as Belichick is, but he's done Belichickian things as far as getting the right guys to fill the right spots and building a team with largely, with one glaring exception this year, apparently, largely selfless players.
Right. Well, I think Kawhi is selfless. I'd like to know all of the secrets in the Spurs Kawhi Leonard saga. I am not going to conclude that Kawhi is at fault here. I mean, there's enough indications that he may be healthy, you know, close to healthy enough to play, but the way he has played throughout his career and the way he's acted, which is completely humble, quiet, you know, never getting in trouble.
He was a very Spursy guy.
No ego in terms of, you know, wanting attention, wanting the spotlight. He just goes out and plays excellent, and he does it on both ends of the court, you know, game in, game out, year in, year out. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt until the very end.
Yeah, it's, I'm curious to see how the whole thing plays out and the talk, that little rumblings here and there about Kawhi to the Celtics.
Yeah, interesting. That's a fun rumbling.
But getting on to more important things, pools.
Oh, yeah.
March Madness.
Right.
Surprisingly enough, after the complete red pen festival that my first round was, things turned out all right. I participate in a pool for fun with a suggested donation with guys that I used to work with out in California. And that one wound up finishing about 14th, 15th percentile of it, which, given all things considered, I'll take. And the reason for that is lucking into three of the final four.
Mm-hmm. You can't say lucking into it. That was a wise group of selections you made.
It was fair. The interesting one that everybody hit on was Loyola Chicago, that I think it was 0.0003% of all ESPN brackets had Loyola Chicago.
Right. When you went 3 out of 4 in the final four, Loyola was not one of your three.
Yeah, conspicuous by its absence. But in the important Fox versus Hansen, when last we left you 2 weeks ago, I was ahead by 1 point.
It was nip and tuck.
It was nip and tuck. It is no longer nip and tuck. I had 66. He had 49.
Yes.
So now we'll move on to bigger and better things, the Masters, and figuring out who's going to win that thing.
Right.
That would be the bigger and better. But the thinking about the Masters, par 3.
Yes.
Yesterday.
If you missed it, you missed quite a bit.
So do you have haiku?
Sure. Of course I do.
I saw you pick up your phone. I'm like, yep, he's got poetry. Go.
Tom, Gary, and Jack sit and chat on bench at 9. Tom leading par 3. Watson lofts a wedge over Augusta's Ike's Pond, sticks it 6 under. Jack's grandson takes turn, draws one back downhill for ace, bringing Jack to tears. Watson holds his par, the leader in the clubhouse at age 68.
Yeah, what that really is to me is proof that if you have touch, that it's a hard thing to attain, but with a par 3 tournament like that, it's really a difference maker. And Watson, the name of it escapes me right now. He wrote a book on the short game years ago, which, when I golfed like I was religious about it before I had kids, that was something that was a must read. And by all means, I mean, you follow the philosophies and approaches in that book and it makes you a far better golfer. And obviously those are things that have never left him. He just knows how to do it.
Yeah, and he certainly has been training a little bit more than the other two in the group, the other two legends, because Tom is playing this week at age 68. But what was amazing out of that threesome is that Jack Nicklaus is 78 years old.
Yep.
Gary Player is 82.
Yeah.
And at one point, Tom Watson was in first place at 5 under. Nicklaus was in third at 4 under. And Gary Player was in fifth at 3 under. And they were by far the most impressive group on the day. They just kept hitting these, you know, 100 to 130 yard wedge shots to like 6 feet. They were getting up and down out of the sand, hitting 20-foot putts. It was really amazing. And you, to your point, you know, when you master the short game for 30, 40 years, it's kind of like riding a bike.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work to get there, and it's fun to work on it. Everybody wants to go to the driving range and stripe it with your driver, but it really is fun figuring out, okay, what can I make this ball do? What kind of shot can I hit? And it's really indicative of the amount of time that those guys spent on the course way back when, just honing their craft. I mean, really, that's the drive for show and putt for dough adage, but you also have to chip for dough, because if you get in a little bit of trouble, that's the difference between those of us who are going out and playing bogey golf and the guys who are plus handicaps, is what they can save. Like, you look at Tiger Woods and he gets in trouble and he winds up with a bogey or a double bogey. If that was one of us, you either take the highest possible for your handicap or you're in double digits. Like, there is no saving those.
Well, talk about scrambling. I heard a stat yesterday that Paul Casey, in the last 3 years at the Masters, has never made worse than a bogey. So yeah. 12 rounds in Augusta, and you never make a double. That's because those guys know how to scramble, and they have great short games. And speaking about practice, one of the fun quotes yesterday from the par 3 contest was Lynn Swann talking about Gary Player giving some instruction to a bunch of executives at some event down in Florida. And Gary Player said to them all, you know, I don't really understand why, if you're a amateur golfer and you maybe play one round a week, why you would ever get upset at a bad shot, because you don't practice.
Right.
And so Lynn Swann decided after that tutorial, he wasn't going to get upset anymore at his bad shots, unless he started practicing every day.
Right.
To be able to play like these pros, it has to be a full-time job.
It's not a fair expectation of yourself. When I played a lot, and I mean, I was playing 50 rounds a year, if not more, and practicing a fair bit. And when we weren't practicing, I had a long hallway in the apartment that I was living in with three of my buddies, and we'd chip back and forth and putt back. Like, we did it a lot. And you, at that point, you can get frustrated about things, because you become acutely aware when you're on the course. Okay, you got out and maybe you didn't have the proper warm-up, and you go out your second hole and you throw out a double bogey on a par 5, and you're like, I just blew the entire round. Mm-hmm. And the toughest thing to do at that point is say, okay, I need to reset and get everything back where it is, because it's not blown. I can still fix the rest of it. But oddly enough, where I started to improve because of work, I was playing with clients a lot. And it doesn't really reflect well upon you when you're with clients if you're throwing golf clubs, snapping things on your knee, hitting every ball in your bag into a water hazard. Like, none of that stuff works all that well. So that really was where I kind of reeled in my golf course demons. But the sooner you can get out of your own head with that, the better of a golfer you wind up becoming.
Do you know who has practiced a bunch?
Who?
Jack Nicklaus's grandson.
Better believe it.
Yeah, so the tradition at the 9th hole of the par 3 contest is that the caddies get to take a shot.
Because why not? You get to use the pool from 1 to 115 on caddy day in Caddy Shack, so that...
Yeah, and they've carried the bag for all 9 holes. It's not a real heavy bag.
No.
Because you're not carrying around the woods. You just need the irons.
And they're not even woods anymore anyway.
Right, the metals.
The metals, yeah.
So it's his turn at the 9th. All the legends have already teed off, and Jack's grandson steps up. And first of all, he takes a practice swing. And you can tell from the looks of his practice swing that he's taken a lot of swings before. He almost looks like a professional. And not surprising, he's part of the Nicklaus family. So he looks great.
Flowing robes, the grace.
Yeah. Then he steps up and lobs it onto the green, and it lands in the back right in that spot in the green where you're trying to hit, and you can tell that he's strategized about this shot.
Well, yeah, of course.
So he lands it in the spot on the green where he knows that if he's sort of entering the funnel, it's going to take it down towards the cup, and maybe, just maybe, it's going to go in. And sure enough, it did.
It goes in. That was I watched ESPN this morning. That was the number one on the SportsCenter top 10.
Yeah. I mean, it was magical. Yeah. It was so unbelievable that Jack Nicklaus, after the shot, went on to say that it was the most memorable event he's ever had on a golf course.
I have a hard time believing that a guy who won the Masters in 1986...
At the age of 46.
At the age of 46, that would be... And you think about his epic battles over the years with everybody from Ben Crenshaw to Arnold Palmer to Tom Watson to...
Gary Player.
You name it. It's a big deal. But again, family man.
Yeah.
An important thing to him.
It's the family dynamic just makes it so much different.
Yeah. That's a lot to say for a guy whose entire life has been golf. And if he's not playing, he's designing courses or you name it. Like an absolutely legendary life. And for that to rank at the top for him is pretty special.
Yes, indeed.
So now thinking of this, that dovetails nicely into a topic that we wanted to talk about last week and just ran out of time on, which was the Blackhawks emergency goalie, Scott Foster, who does what every one of us, I remember going to Dodger games as a kid with a glove, thinking, like in kid logic, maybe if somebody gets hurt, they'll need me. me above the other 56,000 people that are here, sure. Scott Foster, because he's an emergency goalie, and come to find out that they don't actually get paid for this.
Which is unbelievable.
Preposterous.
It should be illegal under the CBA.
It should be something, but you should at least get some kind of stipend for showing up. Instead, they get free food in the press box, which at the minor league level wouldn't be anything to write home about. The major league level might be all right.
But... Now, is that before the game, during the game, or after the game? I mean, is it only if he plays he gets fed?
He gets food, he gets food regardless. Yeah, so that's the incentive, is that. Apparently, though, so Scott Foster, in case you missed it, played, 14 minutes of professional hockey for the Blackhawks.
Made NHL seven
saves.
Hockey.
Yeah, seven saves. Did not give up a goal. And this is in the middle of busy season. He's an accountant. In the middle of busy season, he goes and does that, which is no small feat. And
gets rewarded with a hamburger and some fries.
Gets rewarded, maybe, hamburger and fries. Although, you know, sometimes that press box buffet is pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like at the Blackhawks. But so that's what he gets out of the deal. Meanwhile, the NHL is touting buy your Scott Foster gear, of which he gets $0 and 0 cents. Other fun facts that have come out of this whole thing, the New York Rangers have a backup, an emergency goalie jersey that they all wear, or that the goalies wear. It says Mick Backup. And the number on it, it says Mick Backup 69 on the jersey. And I don't know what you would do if the guy actually needed to go in the game. Right. Like, hey, you can wear this.
Right.
Like,
well, if you think about it as from the organizational level, hopefully the guys in the locker room, the rest of the Blackhawks, will step up and do something for him.
I would hope so. I mean, he went from relative obscurity to doing a few interviews to now saying, I want to go back and be obscure again, please.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he's
too bad. Too kinda late.
Yeah. It's
he's a cult hero now.
He took a bite of the apple. All the evils are now out into the world. But it's a phenomenal story. You wonder how any of us would deal with any of that, though, if they grabbed somebody from the BMBL and said, go sub in for the Celtics for a night. Or I think back to college, I had a fraternity brother who was an equipment manager for the USC basketball team. And it was toward the end of a horrible season. It was a 96 season. Charlie Parker had a forgettable tenure as a coach for USC. And there had been a number of injuries and suspensions, you name it. So they started the equipment manager in a NCAA Division I basketball game.
He actually started.
He started and scored points and played. And great guy. Like his, we also had the side benefit with him of his dad was a professor of exercise science. So he had the keys to the on-campus gym, not the gym that you could go into with your key card. He had the keys to the on-campus gym that where like the basketball team practiced.
Okay.
And so we would go in there at night and go play. And that's,
well, you did the school a favor then. You helped get him into game shape for his big opportunity.
We used to have some good battles in there late night and go play. But he was all right. But he played, he went from playing intramurals with us and sitting the bench a decent amount to playing Division I. NCAA basketball, I think he's suited up against Arizona State, Oregon State, somebody with a state in it.
One of the beauties of sports, those dreams coming true, those long shot dreams.
Yeah, you never quite know what's going to happen. So,
if even for one day.
Yep, and we were talking about it last night. The guy from Brockton, Mass., who is an amateur who played a practice round with Tiger Woods.
That's right.
Okay, sure. He was 9 years old when Tiger won his first Masters.
And Tiger is the one who inspired him to get into golf.
Yeah.
And then he's in the U.S. mid-amateur. He's down 5 with 8 holes to go. And he comes back to win. Tiger Woods writes him a letter. And he's inspired by his service as a firefighter. And then they get to play 9 holes together at Augusta. Wow.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. But you get that, the random stories in professional sports that are like that. And it makes you enjoy what sports is about for a little bit and forget about some of the other trivialities or conflict manufactured for the sake of conflict or you name it. So that's, you want that stuff. It makes you feel a little bit better about what's going on in humanity as a whole. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Bedford High lacrosse coach Matt Girard right after this. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Back here on Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1, Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by Bedford High boys lacrosse coach Matt Girard. Matt, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So for many of us, and me included as a West Coast transplant out here, lacrosse is a new sport. It's certainly not something generational where my dad took me out back. My really only experience with lacrosse was when I was working in minor league baseball years ago. I had buddies from the East Coast, and we'd go down on the field and play catch. That was about the extent of it. Do you find that you're recruiting athletes to play lacrosse, or is the lacrosse infrastructure here strong enough to provide you with a pipeline?
Well, I think the quick answer to that is yes and no, simply because the sport has become so popular in the town of Bedford that, you know, we really haven't had to recruit players to play. By the time they get to the high school, we've always had a very high influx of players, usually around 20, 25 a season that want to participate and play on the lacrosse team and participate in the program. So the demand has really been so high that we haven't had to put a huge emphasis on recruiting athletes. We actually had to add a freshman team a few years ago to accommodate that high demand of players that were coming into the high school. So we started with two teams with the JV and varsity level, and then over the course of the years, as the sport got, you know, highly popular in the town, we had to add a freshman team. However, I do recruit athletes. I definitely, you know, try to find kids when they're in ninth grade in my wellness classes. You know, that I get to watch run around and show their athleticism every day. I try to recruit them to come out to the sport and you know, give it a try. And if they don't like it, you know, it's never a hard feeling. It's just moving on. And you know, we've been fortunate to grab a couple of those athletes and turn them into lacrosse players over the years. Really good impact lacrosse players for our program.
It's pretty cool. It certainly is something, watching it as a more of a casual fan, doesn't look like an easy sport. I mean, there's a lot of contact. There's a lot of strategy that goes along with it, not to mention the physical fitness for the kids. But looking at this year's team, walk us through this year's. Who's back from last year and who's new and going to be some impact players for this year?
Well, we bring back a lot of guys from last year. So for us, that's a big bonus. We did lose a couple of key important guys from last year, including an All-American defenseman and Cormac McCarthy. But we bring a solid core group of guys back that had really huge impact for us over the last couple of years. This senior class has been with me now for 4 years, and you know their impact is tremendous every single year. Offensively, we return Kyle Fink at attack. He brings us 56 points again. Coming back this year, Devin LaFrance at midfield, along with Ryan Toscano, who brings back 50 points from last year. We've had the opportunity to move some parts around with Jack Cusack coming back. We moved him from attack to midfield, and already in a couple of preseason games, he's had a huge impact for us. And the starter from last year, and Stuart Kirkpatrick coming back on offense. So we bring back, you know, over 100 points in offense from last year. So offensively, I think we're in a really good spot. And also on the defensive side, we bring back Eric Flynn, who led us last year with 51 ground balls. Our entire starting defense, three of our four from last year come back, and Colton Krasinski and Dimitri Anagnost and Reed Kirkpatrick and Brian Barlotta at LSM, along with Eric Flynn. I think we have one of the best 1-2 punches in that position in the state. So we have a huge returning group of kids that have really had an impact over the last few years, and really look forward to seeing what these guys put together for the final season.
Here with Bedford High boys lacrosse coach Matt Girard. So looking at that, it sounds like you have a strong offensive core coming back as well as a strong defensive core coming back. Of course, when you played, you had a great career as a goaltender. Are you more offensive or defensive minded?
Well, I think when I first started out, obviously I was a little more defensive-minded, but you know, as my coaching years grew, I had to start to, you know, really understand a lot more of the offensive side of it, a lot more of the in-game strategy of offense. So I think by now, you know, after doing this for coaching for 17 years, I've been able to develop a balance, you know, of offense and defense, and obviously, you know, goaltending. Intellect along the way. So I think that's really helped us as a program, not just being one-dimensional on a coaching staff. We're able to, you know, bring different elements, you know, into our coaching from different parts of the game that have really made us successful over the years.
It's always a good thing to learn, particularly like you're used to being on one end of the field. The more that you can learn, the more that you can incorporate, of course, the better the program will be. And for you, you've been with this program at its helm since 2007. You've seen the team win over 60 consecutive games in Division II, seen it rise from D2 to D1. How much more competitive and challenging is D1?
Oh, it's much more challenging. I can tell you that much. I know, you know, when we were in Division II, we always challenged ourselves. It was one thing that I put a major emphasis on, especially when I had the feeling we were going to have the opportunity to move up into Division I, was to challenge ourselves while we were in Division II to slowly get ourselves ready for Division I. Because in my opinion, if you want to be considered, you know, a legitimate program, and you want, you know, to be considered one of the better programs or even the best program in the entire state, you have to play in Division I. You know, we never hid behind, you know, our enrollment numbers that didn't put us in Division I. We, you know, that was always an emphasis of ours, is to play out of the division and play out of state. You know, so when you get to Division I, I think if you are, you know, you're in a division where every game matters, every game counts. You have to play 100% every single game, because you know, the competitive level amongst a lot of these elite players kind of boils over into the spring from fall and summer and from their club team. So it becomes extremely competitive in Division I. And that's kind of been an elusive thing for us the last couple of years, is getting ourselves all the way to, you know, that final game. But hopefully this year we have what it takes to put it all together to get there.
Coach, as you look ahead to this season, what do you think will be the difference to try and reach that peak and get past the likes of BG and Pickerton all the way to the top of the mountain?
Well, I think it starts with real fast starts in our games. I think getting mentally into the game and physically into the game right off the start for us is going to be very important, which means we're going to put together 48 minutes of good lacrosse every single game. We haven't always started very well in every game that we play, so we may only put in 36 minutes or a half a game of full intensity lacrosse, but I think this year, in order for us to get there, in order for us to reach the final and get to where we want to be, I think every game is going to have that real fast start for us that we really need. And I think going down the stretch when you hit the playoffs, if we can limit those mistakes that may have plagued us throughout the year, if we can limit those from playoff time, I think we can put ourselves in a good position to get where we want to, as we have every single year.
Here with Bedford High Boys lacrosse coach Matt Girard. And so looking back a little bit for you, of course, you played down in North Carolina back when. When did you start playing? How early were you exposed to the sport?
I played baseball my whole life up until the end of my sixth grade year. And when I got in my seventh grade year, junior high, all of a sudden, if we were hit with this sport, a lot of us were, and there was a modified team in the school, and a lot of us, like a lot of kids now, they kind of start switching sports when they find something that might intrigue them a little bit better, and I found lacrosse when I was in seventh grade and fell in love with it, the first day, and it's always been a huge part of my life. It's always been very important to me, the success of our program and the success of these student-athletes. It all started way back then, and I try to instill that passion in these kids now that hopefully this isn't just ending high school for them, that they can continue with it through college and they can continue with it through their adult life and through possible coaching opportunities for them. I try to instill that in them that lacrosse can be more than just a game, and that it can impact your entire life if you want it to.
Now, for those of us who have poked around a little bit and seen some of the players that have moved on to other programs, I saw something nice on the Coast Guard's Facebook page about Colin Cashin, who's now playing there, and you can see some other players who playing for BU as well. How many players have you sent on to the next level?
Oh, man. That's a good question. I actually have a record of that, so I never forget. But I want to say we've probably gotten to at least, over the years, probably 25 kids.
Wow.
And maybe even reaching 30 kids that have gone on to play at the college level, whether they played at Division I, Division II, Division III, or some kids go on to even a club program where the IMCLA in the United States is even competitive to a lot of regular sanctioned NCAA colleges and Division I, II, and III programs. So wherever they choose to go, I'm always supportive of what they want to do and where they want to go, and obviously try to put that emphasis on education first. That lacrosse might not work out for every player for 4 years. Sometimes they may life gets in the way, injuries and so on, and lacrosse doesn't become the number one focus anymore. So we always try to push education first, so you've got that fallback if lacrosse doesn't work out, but. When our guys go to play in college, they seem to find a lot of success, in where they're going, and they're able to adapt very quickly to a little bit faster game and to a different type of coaching style. And we try to keep up with our alumni a lot. I try to do a lot of postings, for them, a lot of really good things. I know our starting goalie from last year, Sean Tierney, this weekend is going to be on ESPN. His Pitt lacrosse team, his club team plays Liberty, and it's going to be on ESPN3. So, it's really exciting to follow those kids and watch those kids as they grow into adults and move on into college and play. So it's a lot of fun to watch the success of the alumni.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun, too, for you, I'm sure, being able to watch them on TV without having to go anywhere.
Yeah, it's really nice, especially with all the social media and the highlights and all of that stuff. I'm able to watch You know, a couple of my players, alumni players from over the years that are now at UNH playing. I believe we've got four of them there right now, and I was able to watch online. They were in spring break out in, I believe it might have been out in Utah over the last couple of years. I was able to watch those games streamed live and watch our guys, you know, excel and have a lot of fun while they're playing. So it's definitely a blast to be able to watch them continue to, you know, build on their success that they had here.
So for young players who hope to join the Bedford High lacrosse team and play for Coach Matt Girard, what kind of advice or opportunities would you give?
Well, I would say, you know, even if you have the smallest desire to play lacrosse, you watch a friend play, you know, you watch a brother play, you know, a neighbor, is just give it a try, right? Give it, you know, 20 minutes of your life, pick up a stick and start throwing the ball around. And if that's something that, you know, intrigues you and you want to continue to try it out, there's so many opportunities out there, you know, just to try it. I mean, we have, you know, in our club program in the New Hampshire Tomahawks, we have kids starting to play lacrosse and learning the game of lacrosse and trying to improve skills as early as kindergarten in a futures program. So we're pushing the sport much younger now onto the kids, you know, and giving them those opportunities. So I would say, even if it's a sport that you watch on TV and say, wow, that'd be fun to play, I would just say give it a try. And you know, it doesn't hurt in you know, trying out those skills. And if you find out you don't like it, then, you know, you can always move on from there. But giving it a try, I think, you know, for a lot of young kids is the most important thing. You know, but I would say don't quit what you're doing. We're big proponents here of 2- and 3- sport athletes.
Yep.
And playing multiple sports. So we always want to see those kids, you know, playing, you know, football, hockey, lacrosse, or, you know, soccer, basketball, lacrosse. We're always, you know, really looking for those crossover sport athletes because they take so much from different sports and add it especially into lacrosse. You know, so as many sports as you can play by the time you get to high school will definitely put you in a really good position to succeed.
I was going to say, in a lot of those cases, too, the things that you pick up from one, if you're a good soccer player and have picked up footwork, that will carry over, or just court vision, field vision, all those skills translate across sports.
Yeah, some of our best athletes, you know, their number one sport might not be lacrosse. You know, it could be their number one sport is basketball, and they play great one-on-one defense. And when it comes to lacrosse season, they play a specialized position called defensive midfield, where they're always playing one-on-one, so they're able to translate, you know, those good skills from one sport to another. And we're always pushing that, no matter what, here at the high school. In all sports, we're always supportive of multi-sport athletes, and you know, we know how important it is to, you know, get those kids to learn different skill sets in different sports and, you know, translate them to our own individual sport. And we've had so many of those kids, you know, cross over and play lacrosse for the first time when they get to the high school and love it. So even if you've never played until you get to the high school, there's obviously always an opportunity here to start, and you will always encourage that.
Awesome. Well, great to hear it. We wish you all the best this season, and hope to catch a game when the weather's a little bit warmer, and
hopefully it warms up soon.
I was going to say, when it actually feels like spring. So thank you, Coach. We appreciate the time.
All right, guys. Thank you for having me.
Take care, Coach.
That was Coach Matt Girard of the Bedford High Boys lacrosse team sharing some time with us, and we'll be back after this. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and it seems like you turn on ESPN has their things that they love, and I should probably consider watching other sources, but it's what's available to me. And they have their things that they love. Occasionally, it's Tim Tebow. Fortunately, we've spun out of the axis of the Kardashians of the basketball world, away from the Ball family.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it is showtime.
Shohei Ohtani time.
Showtime. So
he sort of has taken the place of Tebow.
He is very Tebow-esque.
As the new baseball focus of a very unique story.
Right. So is there an Ohtani-ing? What do you have to do to Ohtani?
Well, you have to. Here's what you have to do.
I was going to say, this is going to be a very tall order.
You have to start as a starting pitcher in the major leagues.
Yep.
And be able to win. And you have to be able to bat as a designated hitter. So you're such a strong hitter that you're going to fill the DH role in the American League and hit home runs. That's all you need to do.
That's really all.
It's just be a elite pitcher and batter at the highest level of baseball in the world.
So it's weird. You sent me over goals, Shohei Ohtani's goals, which I found to be at once intimidating and daunting and scary and also completely devoid of fun.
No fun?
It didn't. Not, like, the only fun part of that to me was playing baseball. It was far too much. I must do this and this and this. And this is the age at which the weirdest part to me was I'm going to have a son at this age and a daughter at this age. I didn't know we could select the gender of our children. Did I miss that part?
We can't. But like you said, these are goals.
They're goals. But what happened? Like, that's a weird goal to me because that is not something that you can say, okay, I'm crossing my fingers. It better be a boy this time.
Well, another one of his goals is to throw the fastest pitch ever, and it would be 108 miles per hour is what he set his goal at.
Okay, so, but for me, I look at that, and it fulfills all the qualifications of a goal, or the smart thing. But my thing is 108 miles an hour. Okay, that's a nice goal to have, and it's a vanity metric. I'm talking about marketing. Oh, my God. But it's a nice goal to have. But what's the benefit of it?
Well, it makes you strive to be elite. You can't just show up and be a starting pitcher in Major League Baseball and a DH in Major League Baseball capable of hitting 25, 30 home runs if you play every day.
Right.
You have to strive for excellence. And he set his goal so high that, you know, he's got to push like crazy to get to the top. These are goals that probably aren't attainable, but it's the way he has tried to motivate himself throughout his life to reach the level he's at right now.
So what age does he have his first Tommy John surgery?
Oh, that's not part of it.
Okay. Because it will be if he tries to throw 108 miles an hour.
Well, I saw that he had some...
You will shred your UCL.
Yeah, he had some work done on his UCL just this past winter.
Yes, yes, yes. He had like a strain. Well, it's easy to come back from a strain, but there are organizations that where you're throwing from a crow hop, where guys are throwing 110, give or take, out of the crow hop. Driveline has a system that they use, weighted balls. You throw with the weighted balls, then you throw with something that is baseball weight, and you're just gassing it. I think there's benefit to that. I think there's benefit to strengthening your arm. However, I look at something like that and I say, focus. I would rather focus on the result of, am I getting batters out? Am I being effective? Am I perfecting my craft? Than a vanity of 108 miles an hour. But then again, you look at it and you go, he's a kid. He's 23.
Yeah, and these goals were set at some point before age 18.
Yes.
Because what he did was he set a goal for each year between ages 18 and 42.
Yes.
And, you know, his goal was to join a major league team at the age of 18. What he ended up doing, though, was he stayed in Japan and played professionally over there. And he did hone his craft there. He already has had two seasons in Japan where he had 10 wins on the mound and hit 10 or more home runs. He's the only person to ever do that in Japan, and the only person to ever do that in the U.S.
Yep.
Is, of course, the Babe, Babe Ruth.
Right.
So now the question is, can he do it in the U.S., in Major League Baseball, and what a start he's gotten off to in the first week of his first season.
Well, particularly because we came out of spring training with them saying maybe he needs to go down to the minors.
Right.
He's not been terribly effective. And I don't want to get way ahead of ourselves on the pitching front. He threw hard in his outing, but, and I watched the last couple innings of it, he kind of, there were some things that he struggled with. And yeah, if you're throwing 108 miles an hour, you're going to get guys out. But if you're throwing 100 miles an hour, if you don't have something else, hitters are going to tee off on you. And that something else could be location. It could be a change in velocity. It could be some kind of a breaking pitch. You need to have a little bit of variety. Any major league pitcher will tell you that. So, I mean, his first outing was nice. Six innings, 3 earned runs. A quality start, which is always one of those stats that's driven me nuts, because if you strung together a season of quality starts, you'd have an ERA of 4.5. Meh. You're right. Not going to make the Hall of Fame from that.
No, but it's only his first start. He also got 6 strikeouts. He struck out the first batter he ever faced.
Yeah.
And his last full season in Japan in 2016, he had 10 wins. His ERA was 1.86. He had 174 strikeouts in 140 innings and not many walks. So I'm confident that he's going to lower that ERA.
Yes.
But what's been fascinating is sandwiched around that win on the mound on Sunday is what he's done at the plate. In the season opener, he started as the DH. The first pitch he saw, he hit for a single.
Yep.
And then this week on Tuesday, his first at-bat at home in Anaheim, he hit a home run, ended 3-for-4. And then Wednesday, he hits another two-run homer to tie the game at 2, goes 2-for-5, and the team wins 3-2 in extra innings. So the team is 5-2.
Yep.
He's hitting .429 with 2 home runs and 5 RBIs. He's got to win. And there's just nothing else like it in baseball. It's a crazy, unique story.
Right. The Angels are fun, and it's a great place to watch a game. Great place to have a wedding, but great play. Yes. Great place to watch a game. A fan base that will absolutely get behind it. And the thing that I really selfishly as a baseball fan want out of this is I would love for them to contend. I would love for the world to have the opportunity to see Mike Trout play meaningful games in September and in the postseason, because you don't want him wasting these prime years of his career languishing with a team that's right around 500. You want this guy to be able to play meaningful games. It's easy to put him in a classification with Mickey Mantle because of his numbers, but you look at what Mantle did in the 50s and how many championships those Yankees teams won. And yeah, granted, fewer teams in the major leagues at that point, a different game entirely, but you would like for Trout to have that opportunity as well. And it's a great place for him to be able to do it. And he's one of those guys, loves the game of baseball, always has a smile on his face, genuinely appreciates what he's able to do. And hopefully it's a fun team. You got Andrelton Simmons at shortstop. You got Ohtani on the mound. You got Trout in center field. You got Cole Calhoun in right, who constantly running into walls. Great arm for a right fielder. It's a fun team.
And don't forget about Albert Pujols.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to forget about him, though.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, with this week that Ohtani's had, Pujols and Trout are sort of under the radar, which is a lot to be said for Trout, who you talk about is compared to Mickey Mantle. He's putting up numbers through the first 7 years of his career that no one has put up. And Pujols, who's one of the greatest home run hitters of all time and signed the massive deal to join the Angels, and now they're sort of on the back page because of Ohtani. But you already get the sense that they might just mesh together and have great chemistry. And, you know, Ohtani's really in a great spot to be able to learn from guys like Trout and Pujols as he assimilates into Major League Baseball on U.S. soil.
It's funny. You look at Mike Trout's stats on Baseball Reference. He is, through 7 years plus a handful of games this year, all of his career numbers, if he were to retire today, and granted, technically, he wouldn't be able to go into the Hall of Fame because he hasn't played 10 years, but if he were to retire today, based on his numbers, he would be a Hall of Famer, according to just the numbers, not the voting, not anything. And this is a kid who is 26.
Yeah, that's unreal.
Blows my mind. So, all right. So thinking about some of this, and we talked about, I don't even remember what the stadium was called, Anaheim Stadium. It was Edison Field at one point, the Big A. I don't know what it's called. There are a lot of great things you can do if you're a sports fan. We talked about the Masters earlier, and that being a must visit if you are a sports fan. If you are just a regular human being and you go walking into Augusta National or trying to, they will kindly tell you to turn around and walk the other way, regardless of how far you've traveled. So that got us thinking a little bit. If you're a sports fan, what things would you have that are on your bucket list?
Right. So for me, you know, while we're on the topic, it would be to play at Augusta National or to watch the tournament. Really, both would really be the goal, but it's really hard to play that course. So you got to get through the lottery just to watch,
right,
the Masters. To play is a whole nother level. So really anything happening at Augusta National would be on my bucket list.
I would have a hard time arguing with that. The British Open would be another one that I think would just be cool. Particularly played somewhere, Carnoustie, St. Andrews, one of the more storied courses, but having that opportunity to see it there and not on a bright blue sunny day, like there's got to be a hint of rain in the air.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to know which one I'd rather do, play St. Andrews or watch the British Open. They'll probably play it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to play it once if I had to pick, because I got a chance to play a tremendous golf course, the Ocean Course at Kiawah, where they had the 2012 PGA Championship. And it was just a surreal, unbelievable experience. Just a beautiful course right on the ocean. The views, the greens are just immaculate. And so fun to be out on a course where you've seen a major championship play out and all the greats have gone through there. And you hear your caddy say that, oh, yeah, that bunker over there on 18, that's 294 yards off the tee. Rory flew it over that bunker all 4 days.
They're not like the rest of us.
They're not. So just to be out there in that location is really neat. So playing St. Andrews would be up there for me as well.
So, all right, that hits golf. Baseball.
For me, you know, I don't think I've gone to an opening day in the major leagues.
Really?
I went to the opening day.
That's today.
Right.
It's not too late.
It's not?
No, you could go today.
Oh, to a home opener.
Right.
Okay, sure. Well, I've been to the inaugural game of the Portland Sea Dogs.
Really?
So that's the Double A team, yeah, for the Red Sox. That was fun. And I managed to get to two World Series games that were pretty important.
Yep.
When the Red Sox clinched in 04 and 07. But I haven't been to a Major League opening day, so that's something I'd like to do.
The Major League opening days are fun just because it's a blank slate of anything can happen at this point. We used to go to Dodger Stadium every year or for a good number of years, and you'd sit out in the bleachers and tickets for $6. Those were cool. And that was always one of those days that if I was in school and there was an opportunity to go, I'd get the opportunity to get out of school that day. So those are a blast. Opening day of the major league season is awesome. Maggie, and I got reminded of this by Shutterfly a couple days ago. What was she, 4 or 5 months old? Her first game was the Royals opening day in 2006.
Awesome.
Yeah. So we have these pictures and we're looking at these pictures going, my God, we look so young with this little tiny person. Actually, we have a picture of Slugger, the Royals mascot, holding her. But opening day is awesome. I would say regardless of the level. Whether it's indie ball, affiliated ball, you name it, it's just the vibe. And in the minors, it's different. The majors, it's we're here, and it's so great to be back in the ballpark and see the players, eat the hot dogs, the beer tastes so good, everything's perfect. In the minors, it's a different thing because you have these close-knit groups of season ticket holders, and for them, it's like old home day. They all get to see each other again. And in a lot of cases, they haven't seen each other and they kept up maybe on social media or something like that. But that's a different vibe. It's a different feeling. Some of the other ones that I kind of threw out on the list. The World Series, of course, I've been lucky enough to go to a handful of those. Sitting above the Green Monster needs to be on the list now. A dog and a beer at the Red Sox, Monument Park at the Yankees, I would say, has it lost its luster because it's not the old Yankee Stadium? Who knows? I'm always partial to Chavez Ravine, Dodger Stadium on a sunny summer night. And my favorite minor league stadium is the one that in Boulderum when Crash gets released by the Bulls and catches on with the Asheville Tourists. My favorite minor league stadium is McCormick Field in Asheville. My argument on baseball is the more new stadiums there are, the less tradition there is. And I would also, actually, I'd be remiss if I didn't say Wrigley in the bleachers with an old style and a freshly served Chicago dog.
Absolutely. That's mine for stadiums. It's the absolute bucket list, Fenway Park and Wrigley. And you mentioned it almost doesn't matter what happens during the game. It doesn't need to be a season opener. If you haven't been to Fenway,
oh yeah,
and most people listening probably have, but for me, going to Wrigley was a very similar experience because you've got this stadium that's really in the middle of the city, and you just see sidewalks and buildings, and then you walk in, and I just couldn't believe how green the grass looked.
Yeah.
And then you see the ivy. I mean, wow, what a place.
It
feels like a cathedral of baseball.
Right.
So that's on the bucket list for sure.
So baseball, football, it's hard to I would have said the Super Bowl 10 years ago, but it's hard for me to say the Super Bowl now.
Yeah, it's so different with football if you think about the stadiums. And they don't have quite the character of baseball stadiums because, you know, first of all, each baseball stadium is different with the dimensions and the walls and the views. And at least with the new baseball stadiums, like in Pittsburgh, you get the great downtown view.
Right.
In football, you just don't have that. You know, you've got these domes. They're basically the same shape. The field is the same dimension in each stadium. So
can you imagine? Oh yeah, we have this wall that juts in at about the 10-yard line.
Right.
So
right.
don't run an out pattern there. You're just going to run into the wall.
So I've been fortunate enough to go to a game at Soldier Field, which has a lot of character, and Green Bay, you know, Lambeau Field is probably up there. So seeing a game between the Packers and the Bears at Lambeau, I would put on the bucket list. I'd make that trip.
Yep.
But it's also just tough, you know, the experience when you're freezing cold.
Right. It's the George Carlin bit. Have you ever seen it?
I don't think so.
It's baseball versus football. If you haven't seen it, you got to look it up. Some of his lines: baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. In football, you wear a helmet. In baseball, you wear a cap. And he goes through the whole baseball has the seventh inning stretch. Football has the 2-minute warning. Like, baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything is dying. So it's there is a contrast, and it's hard. Like, I think back to great stadiums that I've been to. Oakland Coliseum, where the Raiders play, but more because it's just such a nut house.
Right.
Like, that's more about the fans than it is about the structure. It seems college football is the one that if you wanted the unique experiences of I'm going to Cocktail, I'm going to Notre Dame, I'm going to a game at the LA Coliseum, like, that would be the place to get it because the college football environment has so much culture built up behind it.
Right. Notre Dame for sure. I've heard a lot about the Florida Georgia game.
Yep. From the world's largest cocktail party.
That's right. From my close friends, the O'Gormans down in Atlanta, who I'm thinking about today. And, but I think basketball sort of is in the middle of baseball and football. If you think about the stadiums and the character, if you got a chance to go to the old Boston Garden and watch the Celtics, you know why that's on the top. That was on the top of many folks' bucket lists because you just got that the character of the stadium with the unbelievable Celtics teams of the 80s, and you don't quite get that with the new Garden.
Right, and that's been the hardest thing is we've built these beautiful new cathedrals, but at what cost.
Right. You need the fans, like with the Oakland Raiders, that are just either wacky or extreme or so passionate. So you hear a lot about the Golden State Warriors fans. That's a place I'd like to see a game.
Yeah.
With the guys.
And that's an older stadium, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're, well, they're, yeah. And so they're transitioning to a new stadium. I'm not sure if it's next. I think it's in two seasons, right? So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah.
But for basketball stadiums, of course, we can't forget about Allen Fieldhouse, where the Kansas Jayhawks
yes.
play.
Yes.
And you hear the chant, Rock Chalk Jayhawk. And you'll hear many commentators agree that it's the best place to watch a college game. The other voters go with the Cameron Crazies and Duke
yeah.
as sort of the top two.
And Cameron, I've been to both. I did not go to a game in Cameron. I wandered in. They were doing a graduation rehearsal. And Cameron is cool. It's just, it's a sweet-looking building, regardless of what you think about Duke. Allen Fieldhouse, I got the opportunity to go to a senior night there where seniors give speeches. Everybody throws carnations down onto the floor before the game. That gives you chills to watch that. And senior night in college basketball is almost an anachronism at this point anyway.
All right.
Because who stays more than 1 year? You don't have to. We're going to have to cut our show in seconds. And this is something that we can touch more on. Thinking a month from now, give or take. Actually, it is a month from today. Kentucky Derby.
There we go.
Yeah. That has to be on there.
Yep.
Yeah. A few mint juleps. I might have one today just in just the fact that we're a month away.
1 month ahead.
So with that, thank you to everybody here at Bedford 105.1. Chris Gentry, of course, for his help always. Harry Kozlowski, I'm sorry we ran over. And Bill Jennings, Colleen Richardson, and also to our guest, Bedford High boys lacrosse coach Matt Girard, and my co-host Andrew Hansen. And is Tiger going to win the Masters?
Yes, if I have to pick one, yes. I'm going Tiger.
Jackpot. All right, I'm picking him too. That's safe. We agree. So we'll catch you next week with the Masters results. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.